Tell me the story of Jesus. Sadly, it's at this time of the year that many people hear the only part of the story they'll ever know. Because there is still just enough of the religious aspect of Christmas honored in our country that people do hear something or are reminded of the fact that Jesus was born over 2,000 years ago in Bethlehem. Sadly, they don't know the rest of the story, and the hymn we just sang reminded us of the whole story. How he was born, how he lived, how he died, and how he liveth again. I usually try to take advantage of this time of year to remind us of some aspect of that birth narrative we have about Jesus. Of our four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, two of them give us a narrative of the birth of Jesus. Matthew gives us the narrative from the standpoint of a Jewish perspective. And so he tells those things that fit a Jewish view of Jesus' birth. Luke, being Gentile himself, tells a story from the aspect of what those who were not Jewish would be perhaps most interested in. As a result, we don't have all the facts surrounding that birth. And some of what we do, we have a hard time maybe fitting together. That doesn't mean they don't fit together. It only means we don't have enough information, enough facts at this late date to fully see how they all fit. Because while Luke reminds us of what time it was in terms of Roman time, who was governor, who was emperor, and what was going on in the Roman world, Matthew doesn't mention anything about that. Instead, he talks about who's king of Judea, and what's happening in Bethlehem, and those sort of things. And so we're hearing the same story, the same events, from two very different perspectives. In the book of Matthew chapter 2, it says, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. And they replied, in Bethlehem in Judea, for this is what the prophet has written, but you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him. After they heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. And on coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. As we read that part of the story, I'm sort of struck with the fact that there's a few facts and so forth in there that are a little different than the way we performed them when I was in fifth grade and when we did a Christmas play. I no longer remember what part I had. I know it wasn't anything major. I wasn't Joseph, and I wasn't a shepherd, and I wasn't a magi. Maybe I was just one of the ones that tried to sing the Christmas carols. I don't remember that part, but I remember the event. And as we read the story here, we'll make note as we talk about it of a few things that are a little different than the way it's commonly perceived. Not because we're trying to dissuade people or because we're trying to argue with the text at all, but rather to be true to the text. And the first thing, no doubt, we need to say, and we feel compelled to say it, whether it's necessary or not, is we really don't know what time of year this is happening. Even though in our nation, and for generations and generations, going all the way back to the 400s at least, much of Christendom has chosen to celebrate the birth of Jesus around the end of December, the 1st of January, we really don't know that that's actually when he was born. A lot of evidence indicates probably not. But regardless of that, certainly he was born. That is historical fact. Here's part of the facts that support that. And it took place in Bethlehem. Bethlehem was an ancient city of the Jewish people. We first, I think, find mention of it in the Scriptures all the way back in the days of Jacob. Remember, Abraham and Sarah, when they were very old, had a son named Isaac. And then Isaac has two sons, Jacob and Esau. Esau was a rather profane fellow, and he wasn't close to God, and eventually his descendants become the Edomites and some other nations that were surrounding that region. Jacob, on the other hand, took two wives, Leah and Rachel, from within the extended family that God had said would inherit this land. Between those two wives and two concubines that he had, he eventually bore 13 children, I believe. That's a real misnomer, isn't it? He didn't bear one of them. Those poor wives and that concubine did all the work. But anyway, he became the father of 13. And when one of his wives, Rachel, died, he buried her at Bethlehem and put up a marker for future generations to know this is where his beloved Rachel was buried. Later in Jewish history, we have the story of Ruth, the whole book in the Old Testament, very short, four chapters. But it's the story of a woman named Naomi who was from Bethlehem, who along with her husband and two children have to leave that region and go across the Jordan over to Moab because of a great famine that's taking place in all of that part of the world. And there was food over in Moab and very little in the way of food or anything like that in Bethlehem. While she's over there, her husband passes away, her two sons get married, and then we don't know the circumstances, but both of those sons die, leaving their mother, who is a widow, and their two wives, who are now widows as well. Naomi determines that she's going to go back to Bethlehem. Her two daughters-in-law want to go with her. She persuades one to not. The other one wouldn't be persuaded. Her name was Ruth. She went back with her mother-in-law to Bethlehem, even though she wasn't Jewish. And there they tried to eke out a living, which was very difficult for widows in any culture in ancient times, just like it is today. And maybe even a little bit more so for Ruth because she's not even Jewish. And so there was no obligation of those who lived around her who were Jewish to actually help provide for her living. But in the process of them trying to live there in Bethlehem, by a series of circumstances, guided by God, no doubt, she meets a man by the name of Boaz, an older man there in Bethlehem who was quite well-to-do. And while she was gleaning in his fields, he sees her, he's attracted to her, he wants to do everything right, and eventually they're married. They have a son named Obed. When Obed grows up, we don't know exactly how many children he has, but we know he had at least one son, and his name was Jesse. That's a special name in my family because we have several family members named Jesse. My grandfather, my uncle, my second cousin, and then a third cousin, all named Jesse in our family, but probably not because of that. But Jesse lived in Bethlehem, just like his ancestors, and he marries, and eventually he and his wife have at least 8 children, all of them boys. Probably girls along the way too, only the boys are mentioned with any detail. And the youngest of those 8 boys was a young man by the name of David from Bethlehem. He goes on to become the great king of Israel. And while he was king, God promised him that his descendants would continue to sit on the throne and that one day one descendant of his would come who would rule the world. That's why in the book of Micah chapter 5, much later in Jewish history, the great prophet of the Jews is quoted here in the book of Matthew as saying what he did about Bethlehem. In Micah chapter 5, it says, "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come from me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times." See, the great prophecy was not that someone would come out of Bethlehem who would be a ruler over Israel. That wasn't the challenge of that prophecy. The challenge of it was this: whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. Who was going to be born there was going to have a life before the life that began in Bethlehem. He would be of ancient times. This is why the Jews firmly believed from that time forward that Bethlehem would one day be the place where the Messiah would be born. Today in Bethlehem, still just a small town, but probably much larger than it was in Jesus' day. Still, in this small town, people remember what happened there. In fact, there is in the city a church building called the Church of the Nativity. It's built over the site where many believed in ancient times Jesus was actually born. It's a very interesting history behind it. In A.D. about 120, the emperor of the Roman Empire, Hadrian, who was a devout pagan and who hated both the Jews and the Christians, actually had the Roman government go to Bethlehem and find the place where the people just 120 years after Jesus was born, find the place where they believed he was born, and he had that place covered over with a great temple and shrine to the pagan god Adonis. And he forbade anyone to come to that place to remember the Christ, but only come to honor Adonis. Hadrian was not a greatly loved emperor. Almost as soon as he died, practically everything he did of any consequence was torn down and destroyed by those who ruled after him and those he ruled over. But in the mid-second century, a great Christian writer by the name of Justin Martyr, who was born near Bethlehem and grew up there, became a great leader in the early persecuted church, wrote in one of his writings that not only was it in Bethlehem that Jesus was born, but he even said he was born in a cave. Now, wait a minute. We always thought it was a barn, right? A stable. And yet, even today in Bethlehem, the little residences that keep animals, Bethlehem's on the side of a limestone, side of a valley. And they built their houses up on the side. And that, as far as we know, that's been true all the way back to the days of David and before. And so they often had to either find a little flat spot up on the side of that hill, or even build their houses up with props on the front side so it could be level. And they would often tunnel under their house into that soft limestone, and that's where their animals and other things would often be stored. And that's still true today. And so it seems very consistent with what Justin Martyr said, that he was born in a cave that was used as a place for animals. After Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire under Emperor Constantine, Constantine's mother, who was a converted Christian as well, set about to identify some of the great places in the Holy Land that are mentioned in the Bible, particularly in the New Testament. And when she came to Bethlehem with her entourage, a great deal of effort was put into trying to find out which of these little caves was the place where the Messiah, the Christ, was born. And there was one that all the local residents said was a place. Now, was it the place? We don't know. I don't think we'll know until we can at least ask the Lord himself. But certainly there was one place everyone agreed was the place. And it was the place where the statue of Adonis and the shrine to him had once been, but now just the ruins of it lay there. And so there she had a church built over the top of the cave to protect it. It's been known in history as the Church of the Nativity. In the 500s, it was destroyed almost entirely by, I believe, an earthquake. Some of the ruins remained, and so it was rebuilt in the 530s through 550s A.D., a larger, a little bit more ornate structure. They retained what they could of the earlier one. because of the Crusades and other things, it was again partially rebuilt and even expanded more in the 1100s. And then in the 1500s, one last time, it went through a great renovation. And that time, a great wall was put around it to protect it. And only one entrance built into it. And if you ever go on the internet or go into an encyclopedia and look up the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, you'll see this picture, this great massive wall, this little bitty door. You have to bend over even to go in. And yet that's the only entrance in that the public has. And once you get inside, you find a church building in there. And in places you can still see part of the original church, especially the floor from 326 AD when that first church was built. Part of the floor is still there. Up on the walls you can see part of the church from the 6th century that's been preserved. But then most of the rest of what you see in the outward building is from the 1100s and the 1500s. And if you were being so fortunate as to be carried on into the inner place, there, covered by a curtain, is the grotto, the cave, the place of the Nativity. And now today, again, I've only seen the pictures. But there, the ground inside of this cave that I think is maybe 15 foot long and maybe 8 or 9 feet wide, there on the floor, the whole floor is covered with marble. And at a certain place, there's a huge silver star set in the floor. And cut in Latin around the star, it says something to the effect, "This is the place where Jesus was born to Mary." Is that the place? It's close, for it's in Bethlehem. Is it the exact place? We don't know. God never told us to celebrate or mark that place. But it does show the devotion of believers through all the centuries that even now it still exists, and it's still a very frequently visited place by hundreds of thousands of pilgrims. And to that place, over 2,000 years ago, came some men called Magi. It says that they were guided by a star. The Greek historian Herodotus, writing in some 400 BC, said the Magi were actually men from the nation of Media. In ancient times, long in the 500s BC, the Babylonian Empire ruled over a large mixture of different tribes and sub-nations of people, including the Persians and the Medes. And suddenly the Babylonian Empire was overthrown by a coalition of the Medes and the Persians around 539 BC. And the Medes and the Persians became the rulers of their part of the world. But even before that happened, there had been a great conflict between the Medes and the Persians over to which of those two tribes of people were going to be the dominant tribe. And the Persians won. And so when their coalition became rulers of the world, the Persians became the kings and the Medes became the counselors to the Persians. And their great men were known as those men who were full of wisdom, who were skilled in philosophy, medicine, and the natural sciences. They studied the heavens. They studied nature. They sought wisdom, not only with their own eyes and their own thinking, but by looking out among other tribes of people and seeing if there was anything they could learn from them. And they were, like many ancient peoples, believers in the fact that somehow there was a connection between what happened in the heavens, the stars and the moon and the sun, and what happened on earth. And that somehow those things influence what happened on earth. And so there's a deep-seated belief, not only among the Magi and the Medes, but among many ancient people, the Persians, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Egyptians, the Romans, the Greeks, and even the Jews, that when great events were going to happen on earth, great spectacular astronomical things would be seen in heaven. And whether because there actually is a connection or simply because God tended to accommodate what people believed, we know in fact that's true. Often in the scriptures we even read how the sun and moon will stop their shining and the stars will fall from the sky. And we read that in several of the prophets in the Old Testament when God was actually describing Him bringing judgment on nations, the fall of some and the rise of others. And so these men from the east have seen, it says, a star. And they have followed it to try to find out What does it mean? In fact, in their own mind, they already believe that it means a great ruler has been born in Judea. I found some rather interesting quotations from some of the historians of that time and a little later time. The historian Suetonius, who was a Roman historian who lived at the end of the first century and into the second century, which would mean about 100 years after Jesus was born, in writing in his Life of Vespasian, looking back at the beginning, as we would think of it, of 100 years before, he said, "There had spread over all the East an old and established belief that it was fated that at that time men coming from Judea would rule the world." So Suetonius said 100 years later, a Roman historian says that there was a belief 100 years before his time that a ruler would rise up out of Judea. And that belief was not limited to the Jews. It was a widely held belief throughout all the world. Tacitus, writing only about the same time as Suetonius, again, writing of a time 100 years before, said in his histories, "There was a firm persuasion that at this very time the East was to grow more powerful and rulers coming from Judea were to set up a universal empire." Josephus, the Jewish historian who wrote around AD 70 and afterwards, reported that the Jews themselves had the belief that at about that time, one from their own country should become governor of the entire inhabited world. So clearly there was an expectation in the ancient world that something great was going to happen. So great, in fact, that when Caesar Augustus was crowned Caesar around, about 30 B.C., I think he became emperor, 31 B.C., he was hailed by the Romans as the savior of the world. They thought he was the one. Now forget the part that he wasn't from Judea, or even from the East. But they fed on this idea that a great world ruler was about to be born. And so when Caesar Augustus became emperor, they thought he was the one. The Roman poet Virgil, who died in 19 B.C., was known for his great poetry. He was probably the most famous of the old Roman poets. He had a series of classical poems called the Eclogues. And in his fourth Eclogue, now referred to by many, not Christian even, as a Messianic Eclogue, he said, writing around 25 B.C., that soon a child will be born and he will usher in the golden age of the world. What are all these people looking forward to? A lot of the information we need to fill in the blanks is missing today. But it shouldn't be any surprise to us then that men would come from the East, men of intelligence and wisdom who sought truth and tried to read what was happening in the heavens, looking for a king, a great king to be born. And when they arrive in Jerusalem, they start asking about, where is the king that's been born? Certainly if this is the place, surely the people know. It looks to me like, from what the little bit in the text says, that they got a lot of blank stares. Even though the Jews knew their own scriptures and they knew that one day a king would be born, and some of them, even based on what Daniel said, thought this had to be about the time. There was nothing they knew that indicated he was actually here. And so eventually word of this gets to Herod, the king of the Jews at that time, even though he's not Jewish. He's actually a descendant of Esau, not of Jacob. But he's sitting on the throne, and he's a very paranoid king. During his lifetime, he will eventually have at least three of his own sons executed to keep them from succeeding him as king, so he can make sure the one he wants to be king will be. So he's very paranoid, and so when word reaches him that strangers have showed up in town, very dignified, important strangers looking for the one who's been born king of the Jews, that's when he calls in the Jewish leadership and says, "What do you know about some king going to be born?" And they said, "Our scripture says that he'll be born in Bethlehem." So then he meets with the Magi, and he questions them, "When did you first see this star?" He's trying to gauge how long ago did this happen. How old is the child? That's really what he's wanting to know. And so they tell him, and they get the information about Bethlehem. And so then they go on their way with instructions from him that as soon as they find the child, then come back and tell him so he can go worship the child too. Yeah, right. We know what he has on his mind. Murder. But as they go, the star appears again. This helps us know that probably this star is not a normal astronomical manifestation. There were several great astronomical things that happened around this period of time. Halley's Comet appeared in 6 BC and was visible for 70 nights in the sky in that part of the world. Around 7 BC, Saturn and Jupiter in the sky at night were so close together they were like a double star and almost lit up the night sky. Two of the brightest of the objects in the sky at night anyway, and then when you put them right next to each other, how bright they would be. And then from 5 BC down to 2 BC, every August, Sirius, Canis Majoris, the technical name for the Sirius star, it's the brightest star in the night sky normally. But for 4 years, it actually was still visible in the daytime in the sky. It was so bright. And yet none of those seemed to fit quite what these men saw, and yet the fact that all of those things were happening in the sky was telling the world at that time, in their way of thinking, some tremendously great thing is happening. They just didn't know what it was. But these men came to know what so many others did not yet know. That in Bethlehem, a child has been born who's going to be the king of the world. We note that by the time they arrive in Bethlehem, they're no longer in the cave. They're no longer in the stable. They're now in a house. But they find the child and his parents. And there it says, they bowed down and worshipped him. Almost universally in the scriptures, when this particular word worshipped, in the Greek language, and its root actually goes back into the Hebrew language, when it's used, it is used of worshipping deity. Whether the people mistakenly are worshipping idols, or whether they are knowingly worshiping the one true God. But that's the word used here. They worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. They don't give Herod the satisfaction of easily finding out where the child is. But God has shown to these men what he's doing. Let's look at a few scriptures. I know our time's getting short. But if we look back into the Old Testament, in Numbers chapter 24, Numbers chapter 24, we have a very interesting thing going on. Maybe some of us still remember from our Old Testament history who this fellow named Balaam was. Balaam was a prophet, but not Jewish. And Balaam had a hard time separating his job as prophet for God from taking pay for being a prophet. I have a book in my library. The title of it is Prophets for Profit. Balaam was one of those. He thought he ought to make a buck off of being a prophet for God. So he could be hired to come and prophesy against someone. He's the one that when he was on his way to prophesy against the children of Israel, because he'd been hired by a king to do that, his donkey wouldn't cooperate. And he'd turn out of the road when he'd get to a certain place, and he'd beat it, and he'd get it back in the road. And finally, the donkey just sat down, and he's beating the donkey because, look, time's wasting. I can't make money if I don't get there and do my job. And so the donkey just turns around and speaks to him. And this man, who's a prophet of God, is so angry that he can't go make a buck, that he's ignorant of the fact the donkey's actually talking to him. And he said, if I had a sword, I'd kill you. And that's when God opened his eyes, in effect, so he could see either with his physical eyes or his spiritual eyes that there was actually an angel of God standing there who did have a sword in his hand. And the donkey had saved Balaam's life. That's that Balaam, okay? And in Numbers chapter 24, Balaam has this oracle, starts in verse 15. The oracle of Balaam, son of Beor, the oracle of one whose eye sees clearly, the oracle of one who hears the words of God, who has knowledge from the Most High, who sees a vision from the Almighty, who falls prostrate and whose eyes are opened. That might not have always described Balaam, but at least he's describing himself that way right now. What we see in this is that God didn't just limit his revelation of himself to Jewish people. Here's a man who's not Jewish that God's revealing himself to. Why would we be surprised in the New Testament when God reveals himself in some way to magi, men from media? The descendants of contemporaries of Daniel, when Daniel was in the court of Nebuchadnezzar and Belteshazzar, and eventually of Darius and Cyrus. But this Balaam then says, I see him. Who's the him? Well, he's been talking about the Most High, Almighty. He said, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star will come out of Jacob. A scepter will rise out of Israel. He will crush the foreheads of Moab, the skulls of all the sons of Sheth. Edom will be conquered. Seir, his enemy, will be conquered, but Israel will grow strong. A ruler will come out of Jacob and destroy the survivors of the city. You don't ever find this prophecy even quoted in the New Testament. Some have suggested that's because the Jews were so prejudiced against non-Jews, they wouldn't even quote a non-Jewish prophet who had prophesied of the coming Messiah. But it is clear the Jews believe this was a prophecy of the Messiah. And what did he say? A star will come out of Jacob. A scepter will rise out of Israel. And so men come from Media saying, where is the one born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star. They'd actually seen a physical star in some sense. While Balaam actually says that a star will come out of Jacob. In Isaiah chapter 60, the passage I had Don read for us at the beginning. Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord rises upon you. See, darkness covers the earth, and thick darkness is over the peoples. But the Lord rises upon you, and His glory appears over you. Nations will come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawning. Luke doesn't record the star, but he does record heavenly manifestations the night the child was born. Angels singing in the heavens, bright lights, shepherds being in total awe and dumbfounded by what they're seeing and experiencing. And the prophecy was that light would dawn upon them even though they were in darkness, and that kings would come, nations would come to this brightness. And so they came, magi from the east, to honor him. Psalm 72, one of the great messianic psalms, says at the beginning of it that it's of Solomon, which means the ancients first saw it as his finding its first fulfillment in David's immediate son Solomon, who became king after him. Endow the king with your justice, O God, the royal son with your righteousness. He will judge your people in righteousness, your afflicted ones with justice. Then in verse 10, the kings of Tarshish and of distant shores will bring tribute to him. The kings of Sheba and of Seba will present him gifts. All kings will bow down to him, and all nations will serve him. Verse 15, long may he live, may gold from Sheba be given him, may people ever pray for him and bless him all day long. Let grain abound throughout the land, on the tops of the hills may it sway. Let its fruit flourish like Lebanon, let it thrive like the grass of the field. May his name endure forever, may it continue as long as the sun. All nations will be blessed through him, and they will call him blessed. Certainly this was fulfilled in some measure in Solomon. And yet Solomon, like many others, Joseph, David, and others, were all just prefigures of the great one who was still to come. They were antitypes. They were prefigurings of the real one who would come, that God was sending them the message of. John says at the beginning of his gospel, I want you to catch this. Remember, John had maybe 70 years to think about the things, 60 years anyway, to think about the things that had to do with the birth and coming of Christ before he sets down to write his gospel. And while he doesn't tell us about the star in the east, and he doesn't tell us about the bright manifestations in the sky that night when he was born, what does he tell us in John chapter 1? It says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was with God. He was with God in the beginning. Remember what it said in Micah 5? He is from of old, from the ancient of times. Through Him all things were made. Without Him nothing was made that has been made. In Him was life, and that light was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. In verse 9, the true light that gives light to every man was coming into the world. God put a star in the sky. God put brilliant manifestations in the sky at His birth to let the world know that a new day was dawning and light for the world was coming into the world. The Apostle Peter, one of his two letters, 2 Peter, chapter 1. When he's talking about the prophecies of the Old Testament and how they're fulfilled in Christ, he said, 2 Peter 1 and verse 19, "We have the word of the prophets made more certain, and you will do well to pay attention to it as to a light shining in a dark place until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts." I don't think he's having a direct connection, direct reference to what Matthew said about the star that was seen in the east. And yet, isn't it interesting that he basically refers to Jesus as a star rising in your hearts? And again, our Apostle John, in his book of Revelation, the very end of the book, the last chapter, this closes the revelation that God gives to us. And as far as we have any solid evidence, it's the last scripture. It's the last revealed word of God that we have, even until today. And yet as he's closing that out, he says in Revelation 22 and verse 16, "I, Jesus, have sent my angel to give you this testimony for the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David and the bright morning star." A star appeared in the heavens to let us know that God's star, the star even that Balaam had talked about, was coming into the world. And so we repeat at the end what the Magi said there in Matthew. Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw His star in the east and have come to worship Him. Where is the one? Lives in heaven today, seated on the throne of David in a spiritual sense, reigning from heaven, awaiting the day when He comes back again. Probably what we need to ask is, where is He in our hearts? Has the morning star risen in our heart? Is He what illuminates us? Is He what guides us and gives direction to us and lets us know north and south and east and west in our lives? That's what the morning star did for the ancient ones. What does He do for us? We serve a risen Savior, and He's in the world today. He still rules over all things. He was prophesied long before He came. He was expected even before He arrived. In the ancient world, even though they didn't all recognize when He came, they were expecting His coming. And yet, men from the east came knowing He had come and they wanted to see Him themselves. Magi from the east. If you need to respond to the gospel invitation in any way, you can do that now, during this time while we stand up and sing this song.